is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. A special treat for everybody today. We're having one of our open phone, no guest chat fest today with just Eagle One, myself, and you. And if you're with that esteemed group of folks that are with us live, this is the perfect opportunity. If there is a topic we haven't covered that you would like to talk to us about, or just a question you wanted to roll on the quarter deck and see who would salute it, now's the time to do it. You can call the switchboard at 347-308-8397, 347-308-8397. And if you suffer a little bit from stage fright or you're self-conscious and think your speech impediment is worse than mine, you don't want people to hear it, you can always go in the chat room, scroll down to the bottom of the show page, you'll find the chat room. Scott's already in there, and it's funny because Scott threw a question in the chat room before the show even started, which incidentally is what my co-host and I have conspired to talk about, kind of kicking the ball off. But first of all, Eagle One, my condolences for your team on the basketball court. But y'all did take out the evil seed from Durham, so we do appreciate that.
Well, we're not dead yet. That's the line from Monty Python. No, now the second season starts. So this is the fun part of the year. We've got 68 teams. We should know at 6 o'clock or shortly thereafter who those 68 teams are. And then we're off for a couple of weeks of fun.
There we go. It'll be a good show. And
congratulations. We should congratulate the Virginia Cavaliers for winning both the regular season and the tournament. And Brian McGrath, yes, I know, is in hog heaven right now, or Cavalier heaven, or Wahoo heaven, or whatever the heck the name of the team is. So, good
Brian
for them. They played great.
They did. And Brian, I know you're listening. So I guess you're going to be even more insufferable than you already are. But yeah, I'm real happy for him. he's always a Who fan, and the good and the bad for those that follow Conservative Wahoo, which is Brian McGrath over on Twitter. He shares his joys and his sorrows quite well. If you're a Wahoo fan or a Yahoo fan, that's a great place to keep track of Brian's pros and cons as the day goes forward. I kind of teased at the start with the Scott question, and I could give Scott full credit, but we actually coordinated ahead of time. What we wanted to kick off of, and what I wanted to talk to you about today, is a topic that has a fair bit of legs with people's interest, I think, for a lot of reasons that will probably come up here. And that was the Navy came down to five different contenders for the FFGX program, which if you were went into a coma 10 years ago, and all of a sudden you were brought back and heard this, you might be a little perplexed being that everybody was yelling about, we don't need frigates, but we do. And we're looking at five contenders for a 20-ship build. The final RFP is coming out in 2019, and then they'll cut the contract in 2020. Not as fast as I am, but the program timelines are what they are. And I think what's interesting here is we have another opportunity to do something that we've talked about on Midrats for a long time. And I think we've both written about on our home blogs and over at USNI blog over the years. You have two of the five contenders are modified versions of the existing two LCS classes, the Independence class and the Freedom class. Just to, for the sake of argument and wishful thinking, I just want to cut those two off and put them off to the side. If we wind up going with either one of those Snape ship programs, I don't know what I'll do. But the other options I find are intriguing. We have General Dynamics and Bath Ironworks, which I think has the high-end version of this with the F-100 class. That's that Spanish heavy frigate, light destroyer. Fincantieri, if I pronounced that right, has come forward with the Frim design, which, like the F-100, is already afloat with our allies. But what's interesting about the Frim design is there's a couple of different versions for the Italians and the French out there. The design has a lot of inherent flexibility in it. But as with most ships, if you got the hull right and you got the engineering plant, what you put in the white space pretty much will take care of itself unless you are intent on jumping generations. And I can't get firm details on it, but I think Huntington Ingalls is going to do a modified version of the National Security Cutter, which can be kind of problematic in that. When you looked at that list, Eagle One, was if you were going to pick a top five, or if you ignore the two LCSs, three other ships to look at, was there any other program out there you found interest, or do you think, given the requirements, the need, and also the political background, that's about the right five list that you would have gotten?
Yeah, I think that's exactly the list I would have. Well, not exactly, but I mean, it's the list I'm comfortable with, even with the LCSs on there. I mean, if the requirement, I think we need to go backwards a little bit. Years ago, there was a discussion about the need for frigates. You and I both had it. We've been yapping about it, as you said, for years, and it keeps getting borne out. I think before the show, we were discussing the fact that we've had an Australian frigate deploy with one battle group in the Pacific when because we lost some of our DDGs for some reason. Then we've had, you identified at least two other deployments where frigates were accompanying some of our battle groups, frigates belonging to our allies, and in many cases the frigates were old FFGs from the U.S. Navy, the Perry class. So if the issue is legs, speed, and ability to fight, I think the Frim is a really good choice, and I think the others sound promising too. The advantage of the Frim and the Naval Security Cutter is that it's or National Security Cutter is that they're existing frames. They're already out there, and so is the F-100 Spanish class. So I think not having to invent and rewrite the specs for the ship, other than to add modern weaponry, I think that's a huge lift. Whereas we still got the LCS programs, you've got the unknowns of what happens when you stretch the hull and throw more weight on it and all that stuff.
Yeah, when I saw the number 20 out there, I got really giddy because it's nice when something that yourself and a lot of other people have been screaming about for years actually comes to fruition. Is if you recall, at the end of the last decade, a lot of us were saying, hey, we need to cut our losses, build what we have to build with LCS, but then contract build a couple dozen or so of an existing design frigate until we can get a domestically designed frigate up and running, because we need the numbers, we need the ships, we need the replacements. And it took, 8 to 10 years to get there. But that's what it looks like we're doing. If for whatever political reason, I think, if my worst case course of action comes forward, that would be they feel like they have to select a LCS. Hopefully they'll select the Independence class, the futuristic pointy nose version of the even numbered hulls, mostly because that has the most white space in it for growth. I think it's a suboptimal platform in a variety of ways. I know there are a lot of people who are fans of the National Security Cutter. That would be another fair option, I think, if they wanted to go with Made in America. But I do understand there's a couple of suboptimal aspects to that. But I've always, since this list came out, and even before then, have been a big fan of the Franco-Italian frame design. Even if you want to be political about it, especially with the F-35 coming online, we really have expected our allies to buy F-35, buy American, and they are in large numbers, that it would be a good signal. And we've done it in the past with the Canberra bomber and the Harrier and a few other things. If we said, you know what, friends of ours have good ideas and good designs too, and we may build them here, but we'll take your design and run with it. But that's the real exciting thing, and I think the critical thing with the FFGX program. We need something that's already deployed, fully mission capable. It's displacing water. It's doing its mission. We don't need to do any experiments. We don't need to fiddle around and wait for a hole one and hole two to work out the kinks for half a decade. We've lost that extra room. We need to find something that's afloat. It's almost turnkey. Convert a couple of metric things to Imperial, and let's cut steel and get to work. And I think FRIM gives us the best odds of doing that. You know, will it be more expensive? Perhaps. But I don't know about you. I would rather have three ships that are fully mission capable in a variety of areas than to have four ships that are kind of what you want. I'm willing to take that 20 to 30% delta in cost to get that capability back that I think you'll get with FRIM by some of the other options.
Yeah, I think I don't want to single out the FRIM too much, but it seems to me that there must be some way for the U.S. Navy to lease one of the Spanish type ships, the F-100s, and lease one of the FRIMs, put U.S. crews on them, and let them play with them for a while. I mean, if they're going to do this selection, it can't just be on paper. You know, you don't really know ships unless you've driven them hard and understand what their makeup is at sea. And, you know, that way you're dealing with a known quantity. I would let sailors help make this decision, you know, not just the design guys at NAVC or other stovepipes in the system. I put some real sailors on those ships and go out and play with them.
I just had a vision of if we were going to do something like that, of course, you would have to go in theater to get training for the appropriate shipyard. So you tell a few hundred sailors, hey, we're going to send you to Italy or Spain for a few months to lose a new ship. To learn a new ship. I don't think you'll have a hard time filling those billets. I think you'd be able to do a quality cut on the people that you'd want to send, and you would want to send your best people to do that. I'm trying to think, when was the last time we have done something like that? Now, I know our allies did that a few times with some of our ships during the Second World War. I know during the Korean War, there's a little bit of that going on. I know that the Spanish version of the Oliver Hazard Perry, and I believe the Australian versions, the first ones, were built here in the U.S., so they would have had to come over to here. So even though that experience might not be in the U.S. Navy's corporate memory, our allies have done that in the past and have done it successfully.
Yeah, I mean, I would do that. There are a lot of things I would do to help encourage this program, but it needs to get going. I mean, you're going to build 20 ships. I want 20 ships of this size tomorrow. I don't want them, you know, 5 years down the road. I want them as soon as I can get them. And I think you could, if they're going to choose, this is where we're going to get that LCS thing. You know, let's go through this program of five ships you've decided you might want to use. Figure out the reasons you don't want three of them, and then go with two to play with. And if you want, start you know, tell the there's no reason why the steel can't be cut in Italy or in Spain, pending a decision on which one you're going to go with. And you know what, I'm sure that there's some cost involved in that, but the cost of not having the ships you need when you need them is pretty high for us. And then I would, you know, I would do other things too. We were talking about this a little bit before the show. They've opened up 12 of these Navy Mark VI patrol boats to be lieutenant commands, which is great. I think for the SWO community, the more junior you get a command, the better. Nothing makes you a better CO than being a CO early. One of my best skippers was a minesweep CO, then fleeted up to be a destroyer CO. You know, and his experience in the minesweep really helped him, I think, become a much better CO of the larger ship. That being said, I also think we ought to downgrade the CO seniority for the LCSs and start putting those LCSs to work at things they could actually do, like drug interdiction in the Caribbean and the Pacific, off the Pacific coast. And keep them closer to home, but make them lieutenant commander commands. And you know, I know they're great big ships, but there's a lot to be said for going with a more junior officer. And then you know those guys can then be your seed corn for the skippers of the larger DDGs and the frigates when they come online.
Yeah, and as we've discussed before, there's no reason why you need to have a ship with 100 plus or minus sailors on board be a commander command. That should be a lieutenant commander command. You look at the destroyer escorts; those used to be lieutenant commander commands. Simply from the number of sailors, yeah, it's a pretty big ship. It's the size of a World War II destroyer from a length point of view. But there's no reason besides our very rigid Bupers career path pipeline that we couldn't have that. But I think where you'll run into problems again, it goes back to what's going on in Millington. That class of ships is going to be such a huge part of our fleet in the next decade. And now that it looks like we're going to get rid of the XO to CO fleet up in the service community and go back to having lieutenant commanders be the XOs of ships, that you might not have enough lieutenant commanders to do that. But I did like the news that you just outlined, that we've opened up more lieutenant commands. We've got some great lieutenants out there who are kind of like those good pilots who come off of sea duty and are forced to take some piddly little busy work shore duty job who really just want to fly. You've got some great junior officers out there who go, okay, you're that good? Here, take command and let's see how great you really are. And I think we've both worked for flag officers who came from a different generation, who had opportunities to, I know, Cutler Dawson. He was very proud of the fact he had a lieutenant command, a lieutenant commander command, a captain command. You know, if Cutler Dawson can do that and make 3 stars, there should be more avenues for our very talented surface warfare leaders to be able to do what the best want to do and the best want to be at sea. Give them that opportunity.
Well, the best want to be at sea if they know they're going to get command. And if the command is going to last longer than an hour and a half. I mean, if your fate is going to be, yeah, you'll get command after you've been on staff duty for a zillion years and all this other stuff. You know, that's the reason we lose a lot of people, I think, if in the surface warfare community. Not only is it a hard job, but, you know, we say, yeah, command is the goal, but we make it awfully hard to stick around going through all the stupid stuff on staff work. And part of this to me goes back to how we treat our SWO ship drivers. And I have suggested in the past, and I think a lot of other people have looked at, we need to go the way the Royal Navy goes, where or has done for years, where you have the split out of the engineering officers and the piloting officers, and the piloting officers are the ones, I think, who get command, whereas the engineers become chief engineers. They stay that way. And doesn't that make some sense? We've got a complex world out there with complex operations going on in sea lanes that are more crowded than ever. Shouldn't we be training our junior deck officers to a high standard? That may include getting them merchant marine licensing qualifications and then giving them the Navy training they need, but so that they become specialists and that they know how to drive these ships. And then you can branch out from that into being, the weapons and that stuff. But it seems to me that we really need to take a serious look at this. And I know it goes against the U.S. Navy tradition of every junior officer is a jack of all trades and can do anything, but that usually ends up meaning that you become an expert at paperwork and not necessarily an expert at ship driving.
Yeah, it's. I've always been interested in at least looking at. I use the Royal Navy example of how they separate their officers into weapons officers, engineering officers, and deck officers. And what's interesting, I'm in the process of reading a book from Naval Institute Press about the story of Crew 34. Crew 34 being 1934 of the German Navy, and it tracks the record of those German naval officers in the end of the Weimar Republic, through the rise of Hitler, through World War II, and even post-war, where some of them grew to flag rank at the reconstitution of the German military in the 1950s. And they actually talked a bit about how the German Navy had what they called their sea officers, their engineering officers, their weapons officer, and also their surgeons were also brought in the same group. And I wonder if part of our institutional hesitation is against going to that system is in the German system, a lot of the other continental system, it was very much an elitist organization where the people from the right families and the right backgrounds were your deck officers, so to speak. And it was the smart but middle class that would be the engineers, the weapons officers, and even the surgeons from the bourgeois, so to speak. But they also had a much lesser chance of achieving flag rank, et cetera, and so forth. I wonder if that plays in. I hope not, because we're a much more egalitarian society than that. It is much more of a meritocracy here, I hope, than what it is in that continental experience. So I wonder if that might be part of it. But it should be looked at. I think looked at closely, if for no other reason than we do that, we give our officers in command the opportunity to get lots of experience driving ships, which is like a pilot. I don't care whether you're a Lieutenant JG just coming out of the FRS, or if you're a CAG, a wing commander. How good of a stick are you? How good do you fly your plane? It should be the same. How much experience do you have driving your ship? Because ultimately that's going to determine how much respect the rest of your command is going to have of you, which I think is very, very fair. If you're lousy up on the bridge, that's going to reflect in other things about how your command responds to you. So it would be interesting to take that path at one point.
Yeah, I think that some of the books I've read, like if you read The Cruel Sea and some other of the Nicholas Montserrat books and some of the other ones, I'm not sure the British didn't have the same class distinction between the snipes and the deck officers, and maybe that is part of it, that because, God, who knows, somebody, King got offended by the Brits. He didn't like them at all. Maybe he decided that it was a bad idea to do it the way they do it. And there is something to be said of having the background of knowing how your engineering plant works when you're up there driving the ship. So you do need to have that knowledge. But I know that in our merchant marine, if you're a deck officer, you're a deck officer. I'm sure you are trained in how the plant on a merchant ship works, but I don't think you have to be an expert in it the way we try and turn everybody into a department head and then move them up through the food chain. And even then, that still works if everybody's going to sea a lot. But with this, I hate to keep harping on this ridiculous requirement from the Goldwater-Nichols Act, but our Navy officers do not belong on staffs with a bunch of Army guys and Air Force guys. You know, our world is completely different. And if you ever doubt that, try and discuss what you do on board ship with what an Army guy does. You know, he's got an MOS or a, whatever they call it in the Army, and that's what he does. He doesn't do anything outside that. And, you know, you tell them what our sailors do or what you do, and they're going, really? I never heard of that kind of thing. And even our pilots and other aviators, the NFOs, you know, you're very specialized. If you're a P3 NFO, or P8 NFO, that's a specialty. If you're a F-18 pilot, you're an F-18 pilot. But we don't, and you may also be, you know, a division officer for weapons or admin or something, or department head, whatever. But you know, as you just said, your primary function is flying airplanes, and that really should determine on ships too. That if you're a good ship driver, you should be driving ships. And then you ought to be rewarded for that.
And we've covered it before, but I think it's worth bringing up again. I think that the joint requirements for Goldwater-Nichols were done for good reasons and the right reasons. But I think how it became operationalized, the cure was worse than the disease. Is Goldwater-Nichols was designed so that you would have general officers and flag officers from different services play nicer together. But as a result, what you're doing is you're warping the career development of field grade and company grade officers to the point that they're not able to do their primary job that you want your 03s, 04s, 05s, and 06s do, which is the tactical end. You can play catch up on professional sandbox skills with your other services once you select for a flag, but let those field grade, company grade officers expend their efforts doing that well. And unfortunately, I think Goldwater-Nichols has interfered with that, not maliciously, but just as a byproduct of an imperfect design.
Yeah, and this reaches deep into our the way we create the people we need to have command further down the road. When the destroyer I was on, the CO was in those days they called Mod Squad. He was a lieutenant commander, so he could handle the job. He did the job, as I said, he'd been CO of a minesweep before that. And there were a lot of Mod Squad COs who I don't know what if all of them or any of them made flag. Frankly, I don't know, but they were all, you know, really good, well-screened officers. Now, the fact that our particular commodore at the time would have been the head of the Navy Propulsion Examining Board caused issues because the ship we had was so old that it was hard to keep it running. But that wasn't the CO's fault. That was really a Navy issue because of when you're having a 35-year-old ship, there's some issues that go along with it.
Speaking of old ships, I wanted to backtrack a little bit. When we were talking about, back in the day, the modern carrier battle group doesn't have anywhere near the number of escorts it used to have, mostly because we don't have as many escorts to be. So we have, quote, invited, unquote, our friends to come deploy with us. We have the Truman battle groups deploying this spring with the German frigate Hessen. It's a 58-ton, mostly air defense frigate, but it has multi-mission capable across the broad spectrum of missions, just like our DDGs are. What's interesting, the Hessian is 5,800 tons. The Flight II Oliver Hazard Perrys are 8,300 tons, and the Oliver Hazard Perry class is 4,100 tons. So it's about one-third of the way between the delta, between the OHP and your Flight II Arleigh Burks. And we had this summer one of the ships that didn't make the five cut, but it's a nice class of ship, the Danish frigate, the Peer Willemus, who I'm butchering that pronunciation, but I'm not a Dane. It's a 6,650-ton frigate. That definitely is getting more closer to the light destroyer, I guess. It deployed with the Bush battle group. And also last year over in the Pacific, and this is where before the show, you and I had a little bit of a grin, or at least I had a grin about the Australian frigate, the HMAS Newcastle. It came back for deployment in November of last year with the Nimitz battle group. And for those that don't have their Eric Wertheim Fleets of the World book handy, the Newcastle was commissioned in 93. It's one of the upgraded Australian Oliver Hazard Perry class frigates. It has the, in addition to still having the Mark 13, also has the Mark 41 VLS Ford and lots of other improvements on the ship to make it more modern. So we did have an Oliver Hazard Perry deployed in the battle group in 2017. It just happened to belong to the Queen and not to the U.S.
Yeah, and the reason that this, you know, we're going to harp on this probably way too long, but there was a discussion we had with some senior person back in the day where his point was that we didn't need as many ships because the ships that we had were far more capable than the old but larger number of ships. So one modern contemporary DDG flight two whatever equals four FFGs or something. Well, that ignores the problem that one, I don't care how capable your ship is, it can only cover a certain amount of space on the ocean. And when we're looking at perhaps the need to escort the logistics force to and from an area of some excitement, we have to have ships to do that. They have to be capable ships. You can't just imagine away the threat to your logistics trade. And that's why these 20 frigates are important, and we probably ought to have more than 20. And that's why we really need to have, if they can make some use of the LCSs, whatever variation they're going to have, that'd be a really nice role. They're just going to need a lot more gas stations along the way than some of these ships with longer legs.
Yeah, it's just there's a lot to be gained, and by having our allies deploy with us, because that's what we do, that's how we operate. I think it's also great. I know when I was playing around in the Caribbean, it was always great to work with the Brits and the Dutch, mostly because you could look over at your own radio talkers and go, hear that guy? Be like him. Because they're just really great professionals and great seamen to work with. I think we can learn a lot, and hopefully they can learn a little bit from us. But it would be nice to see a program, and we're almost there right now, where we find some way with every battle group to have an ally send a ship along with us for the deployment. Because whenever the next war comes, it's going to involve allies. It's going to involve friends. And we've got decades of working together, but nothing really makes you learn how to work together than when you deploy as an ARG or a carrier battle group. That is that day in and day out coordination, whether it's getting the brief, getting the station, getting the crypto right, or just, making sure you can understand a bad accent when somebody you don't like comes on watch on the other ship. It's just an incredible opportunity to develop things professionally. I don't know when the last time we had some good personal exchange programs with the French. I don't know when we've had a French ship deploy with us. They're very interoperable, especially since they fully came back into NATO last decade.
We had a French carrier take over in the Arabian Gulf. When we had a gap in our own carrier out there. So, they've been operating with us, and that's a good sign.
Yep, the Spanish, the Italians, the Norwegians, the Japanese, the South Koreans, New Zealanders, they should all come and share. But I know a lot of them have very, very tight defense budgets compared to us, especially when you look at just the percentage. So many of them just may not be able to afford to, but they do come to RIMPAC and the NATO exercises like I'm sure you saw some of the stuff the last month or so. They're doing the usual let's get a gaggle of NATO minesweepers and let's go over to the Baltic and find World War II mines that are scattered all over the place. They actually found one in Oslo Harbor this year. You can't buy training like this category. You can always find that in the Baltic Sea when it comes to mines.
Yeah, I think those are really excellent. My question about RIMPAC, as you discussed it, is it time to disinvite, to not invite the Chinese from playing with us and just to concentrate on the Allied forces?
That would definitely send a message. But you, in some ways, you got to wonder, because, you know, they're spying like you read about. Hawaii is so thick with Chinese spies, it's ridiculous. Same with California, New York, etc. But you wonder who gets more of an intel gain out of it, us or the Chinese. My guess would be the Chinese, simply because it's such a target-rich environment. And I don't think anybody who participates in RIMPAC could be defined as a friend of China. It's pretty much all of our friends and buddies, and then we've got the mean kid on the end of the block that we've invited to our party. I wonder when would be a time to use that as a little bit of a stick to beat them with. I don't know whether I would expect that to happen anytime soon, because if we really want good things to happen in North Korea, we need the Chinese.
Yeah, well, there is that. I was looking at one of the questions I have that we probably ought to address, too, is the Russians now are rattling the hypersonic missile cage. We know that the Chinese seem to be going very hypersonic. The Russians have some kind of super-duper nuclear torpedo, port destroyer, third strike weapon system. You know, how much, and the Chinese have developed so fast, it's kind of hard to tell exactly where they are, but one of the things we've always relied on is we would take the first whack, and then we would come back on our technology and our ability to industrialize rapidly would come up and save us from any kind of threat like this. But are we at a point where we really need to worry about, can tech save us? Or are we pushing the wrong tech? And once you, if you develop something to kill some of these things, how long does it stay in your hands before it becomes, due to the spies and the various network, before it gets stolen and somebody else finds a counter to it?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, the math and the technology is what it is. It's the question is how good is their targeting? And how deep their weapons bunker, so to speak. But war is, as it's always been, it's a come-as-you-are operation. One thing different now than wars that we've experienced in the last century is we don't have much of a strategic reserve. We don't have a ghost fleet, to use a popular term nowadays, otherwise known as a mothball fleet, to draw on. We really don't. Those we do have in there, as we saw with the last year of, are we going to bring back the Oliver Hazard Perry we have in storage or not fiasco. There's really not much there. The key with hypersonic is because of the time distance equation, you've got to eliminate them early, because once they get within a few dozen miles, you're not going to stop them. And they don't have to do much last-minute course corrections like you do with a Harpoon or other subsonic missiles. You got hypersonic. You could turn all you want to, and you could press your chaff all day long. It's not going to make a difference because it's going to be there in 2 seconds. So that goes back to having range. If you need to kill the archer as opposed to taking out the arrow, how do you go and take out that airplane or that submarine or that small surface ship that's carrying that hypersonic missile. And that's something that we have internally taken away from us. We used to have a fleet that had some pretty good legs. We don't. And we don't have organic tanking from an aviation point of view to be able to make that happen. A nuclear submarine is really not the best platform in the world to take out a fast attack craft or a fast moving corvette. So that's part of the challenge, is how do we counter that weapon while still being in such a position that we can move our forces close enough to affect the battlefield? Because if all you're doing is playing defense somewhere between Guam and Hawaii, then in Westpac, for an example, then a large land force can do whatever it wants to on the continent. If you can't get through that hedgehog or that porcupine, whatever you want to look at it. And I really think that's where the push is for these hypersonic weapons. Just like during the end of the Cold War, we saw with the backfire regiments. It's like we need to keep America's primary force projection device, i.e. their carrier fleet, at bay. Keep them at distance. Make it so painful for them that they won't come here so we can do what we want to do on the ground. And if things go on very long, that we have the ability to stop them from effectively reinforcing things across the water. When you look, especially with some of the long range air-to-air missiles that have been developed by potential adversaries, one thing that we are kind of used to is, well, there's an Air Force tanker up there we can get to. What if they start picking off our tankers that are big, fat, slow, and are easy to find on primitive radars? We're used to having a good air picture. What if in the second century or the second decade or the third decade of the 21st century, potential opponents have the ability to do what the Soviet Union had the ability to do towards the end of their existence, which is take out our AWACS, blind us. You can assume from within the first few days, we're going to lose our satellites, or most of them. So that's going to be the challenge. If you come to war with what you have, and if everybody makes the mistake that people usually make and think they're going to have a short, fast, decisive war, and lo and behold, you don't, then what next? Do we have that industrial capacity to build up, not to replace losses? There's been a couple of really great articles recently. I don't know whether you had a chance to read about the 1973 Arab-Israeli War and the extraordinary efforts the U.S. took to resupply the Israelis. The best-known example is with F-4s. Pretty much they would leave the factory in I think it was Missouri, and fly straight to Israel. Painting new colors on it on the way, so to speak. The attrition rate in modern war is something that a few smart people appreciate, but I don't think in the general body it's fully appreciated what that looks like. And one of the best data points is the 73 Arab-Israeli War from that perspective.
Well, I can give you an example from our own experience of Vietnam in 1972 when the North Vietnamese rolled south. Our destroyers went through 5-inch ammunition as if it were chicken feed or something. So, you know, we were lucky we had a reserve at Subic Bay, but even that ran out. They were flying in C5 ammo, 5-inch ammo on C5s, you know, which is you give back a cost, and it was from reserves that had been from World War II. I mean, some of the ammo. Especially for the big gun cruisers and the, you know, that stuff is expensive and heavy and old. And, you know, and it doesn't, you're right, it doesn't take long to run through a whole lot of stuff when things get hot and heavy. And which, you know, one of the points you make is about the legs. And my question, you know, we're talking about having these drone refueling capabilities, the MQ-3 or whatever it is. But in the interim, until we get that, should we bring back some S-3s that are refueling capable and get them on the deck so we at least have some option carrier-based refueling component that's not a buddy tank on an F-18?
I wish we had a guy I served with in NATO, an S-3 guy. And if you ever needed 10 or 15 minutes of dead air time to fill up, you would just ask him about the S-3 program, because that math has already been done. The S-3 community is one of its last gasping efforts to stay alive. Is they did a very good and a very fair study of how much it would actually cost to just have a dedicated, kind of do it the way C2 debts work, but have S3s debt out to carriers as organic tanking. Strip them out of their ASW and surface warfare equipment and just use them as straight up tankers. Incredibly affordable. Really would buy a lot, as especially now, nobody's qualified to work the tube anyway. But it would be a great gap filler until that theoretical drone tanking ability comes on board. Maybe we have the right leadership to take that step right now, being that the people who said no are all retired now, so you don't have personalities driving it. But the S3 debt concept, I think, would be a great gap filler. You'll get the argument from Militant about, well, how do you have a career path for this, blah, blah, blah. You know, not everybody wants to be a battle group commander. Not every aviator wants to stay in forever. And there are a lot of, you know, tailhook aviators out there who don't screen for command. And so they're sitting there as senior 04s, maybe junior 05s, treading water until they are retirement eligible. Say, hey, shipmate, you're a good stick. You saw you didn't screen for command. How would you like to go to sea again and fly tankers? You'd have no problem filling it. Now, that would be a very weird model of a squadron, perhaps. But if there's lots of ways to do it if you want to, if the requirement's there. I just think it's probably too strange, too different, and to be sarcastic, makes too much sense that they would want to go do that, which is a shame, because it would be great to have a drone tanker, but we don't know whether it works yet or not.
Yeah, Chris is making a good point, though. I mean, if they're going to, in the chat room, if we're going to try drone tankers, let's get going. I mean, we've been talking about for, as he says, for 5 years. Let's just do it. You know, one way or the other. And he probably would if we really applied ourselves. And, of course, that would involve getting a budget that is real from Congress so that you have the money to do it. Let's field them. And if they – and don't – you know, we don't have to field 1,000 of them. We just have to field a couple and see if they work. And if they don't work, then we can – you know, you divert to the S3 option or some other organic tanking other than the buddy tank on an F-18, which makes little or no sense to me. But
in that timeline is kind of what we were talking about with FFGX too. And you've heard me say this before, and I'll say it again because I think it's insightful, but it's not. The military is serving the process as opposed to the process serving the military. It shouldn't take 2 years to make a decision. It shouldn't take this long to get things going. Why don't we have a VX squadron working with a drone tanker right now? Test it out. But no, we're going to wait a few more years. And so in twice the time it took to fight World War II, we'll get the first COP2X that has one, or JTFX out there working with one, which is a shame. I think both you and Chris have a good point. You know, we should put it out there. He also made a comment, Chris, you should have called in there, shipmate. We could have given you some airtime. Which, by the way, we got 10 minutes left. If anybody does want to call in, it's 347-308-8397. Hey, and we actually do have a caller on here. So, Chris, you may have lost your bubble. So, hey, let's bring on area code 202. and see who we have. Area code 202, welcome to Midrats. What can we do for you?
Hey, good evening, Sal. This is Jerry. I just wanted to come on. I was listening, and I just have to say that before my next National Review article comes out tomorrow morning, I submitted the article a week ago, so I want you to know that that I didn't just take it right exactly from your show, but I couldn't agree more on the whole MQ-25 program, and in fact I bring up within the essay that you'll see tomorrow morning about going back and grabbing those 87 S3s that are sitting in the boneyard right now and getting going. But you're absolutely dead on that. You know, we actually have the two X-47B prototypes that only have used, I think, about 15% of their wing life that are sitting there. And I know that Northrop Grumman has pulled out of the MQ-25 competition, and that's fine. I understand, you know, their corporate strategy. But the fact is we have two prototypes that we could be going with right now that we could put a buddy store underneath, and we could start operating that in and around the carrier air wing and getting a sense of what's going on. And instead of doing that, from everything I'm hearing in Rumorville, is that Naval Aviation wants to, in fact, put some they want those two prototypes disassembled. They want them to go away because essentially, you know, for a number of different reasons. I could probably give you my paranoid view on it. But the fact is we have the ability to go right now into testing and, in fact, to continue the tests that were supposed to happen with those two prototypes. I think they've only completed about 38% of the tests that we originally contracted for before we put those away. But there's two things. You know, we could get tankers back onto the carrier right now, which we need desperately, a real mission tanker, or move on with the unmanned testing.
Hey, Jerry, let's just for the listener's sake, and I can't believe they're going to take those apart. It gives me a migraine.
Yeah,
it's actually in
the budget. Yeah, it's in the last budget bill. The Navy wants to take them apart.
And for the listeners, they may not be familiar with it. When I said VX, in aviation, the VX are the experimental squadrons. And the home of the experimenters, the test pilots on the East Coast, is in Patuxent River, Maryland. And it is just a blink of the eye from taking off from Pax River to the Virginia Capes, Bay Capes. You just go down the Chesapeake and take a left, and you're right there. Where does all the battle groups do their workup? Where do the air wings do their training? It's almost – you would have trouble designing a better system to test with a buddy store and just maybe, you know, a few hundred pounds of fuel just to start, because the technology will get there. What you really want to work is your techniques, your procedures, and your professional confidence that, you know, the F-18 guys, they pull behind this unmanned tanker. It's just like they're pulling behind a buddy tank in F-18. They got full confidence in the system. We find out, and the fact that we're allocating money to take prototypes apart as opposed to giving this to a group of our really sharp F-18 JOs that just rolled to shore duty to Pax River to the VX squadron, say, "Hey guys, get together with your ACs and y'all figure out how to make this work." It's disappointing almost.
Well, here's the thing though. I think you got to go back to the base case right now. Why is it that Naval Aviation said they needed this unmanned tanker? They needed the unmanned because the tanking mission was putting too much strain on the limited number of Super Hornets that we had that were flying in three wet or five wet formations. The fact is we've reopened up the Hornet line again. So we're producing, I think we had 22 last year, 14 within this budget. The Navy's looking to actually decom early now, 140 of the FNA 18 season D models, because they've got the Super Hornet line up and running. We don't need a quote-unquote tanker now. Now, what that is that's not necessarily a mission tanker so much as a recovery tanker. What we need is penetrating strike. And quite frankly, and you'll see it in the essay that comes out tomorrow in National Review, I say, hey, look, MQ-25, not a program we actually need right now. What we need to do is pivot to try and come up with some sort of an unmanned penetrating strike mission. Which is what I think is the major opportunity that we've bypassed over the last 5 years.
Jerry, if you could, while we have you cornered here and on the line, I wonder if you could just talk for a sec about something that's been making me itch. And sorry if I'm stealing everything from you, Eagle One. But while we've been trying to figure this out, and we've been talking amongst ourselves, our potential adversaries have not been waiting for us to figure it out. Where, for you track and field guys, we're about to get lapped when it comes to the terror of the time and distance formula, where you and I have talked before, and we're talking again here about that need for range and distance, because the weapons are getting faster, and to fight that, you've got to be able to reach them. Talk a bit from your perspective about the development of the, we talked about it a little bit earlier on in the show, the hypersonic anti-ship, but also the long-range hypersonic anti-aircraft missiles that potential adversaries are starting to bring online now.
Yeah, so, I mean, you're right. You're looking at two new oncoming capabilities, which are greatly going to expand the A2AD bubble that surrounds both China and Russia. Those are the two majors that are investing in this type of technology, and we're watching it come. So, for instance, the anti-air capability that's coming on, hypersonic in speed, also precision based upon some of the other capabilities and radars and other sensors are out there. There is no way in God's green earth that we're going to take a big wing tanker inside of probably that 500 to 1,000 mile bubble. So the idea, for instance, of refueling F-35 Alphas or Bravos or Charlies or anything in that range is probably a non-starter. You can't take an HVU airborne thing in there. Same thing that we're seeing with missiles, cruise missiles as well as ballistic missiles, this new cruise missile atomic power that Russia is talking about, that Putin gave his big speech. That's very experimental. We don't know if it's actually going to work, but what we do know is where China is. All of that is coming together to force the carrier back beyond 1,000 nautical miles, if not further. And so we really need to come up with a combination of both aircraft and missiles on our own, hypersonic preferably, given how difficult it is to shoot those down, that has an ability for us still to reach out and get to that center of gravity, Warden's ninth ring, in order to be able to sustain our overall strategy of having short wars.
Yeah, I have a question, Jerry, about the, you described it as an unmanned penetrating strike force. What's your thought on what that looks like?
Well, I think, first of all, it's all aspects stealth. So the one thing about it is everyone says, well, if you start going that direction, your cost is going to go up considerably. The fact of the matter is, though, if you look at the economics of unmanned, that if I build an unmanned platform, I don't have to put it up in the pattern every week to keep it qualified. Once I teach one computer how to fly the mission, all of the computers can duplicate the software. And so even if it comes in at $250 million a platform, in the net length of the overall life of the program, it's going to come out cheaper than some of our manned aircraft. The other thing is the ability for carriage. So I'm looking for something 4,000 to 6,000 pounds of ordnance carriage internal, and I'm looking for range. I'd like to see something a minimum of a 2,500 nautical mile combat range, something that we probably could do with our unmanned platform, and something in the 60,000 pound class, based upon just scaling up, for instance, what we saw with the X-47B, which was a 42,000-pound platform that could fly 1,500 nautical miles.
Hey, Jerry, well, I just realized what time it was. We got to have you on again for a full hour sometime. I know you got a busy schedule, but pop me an email sometime. You mentioned when we brought you on that you've got an article coming out tomorrow. If you could, pimp that article one more time so the listeners can look for it tomorrow.
It'll be on tomorrow morning at National Review. It's an essay that takes on the MQ-25 program and the things that I see that the Navy's done wrong with it. And again, I was listening to you, and essentially you and I, as often happens, are repeating each other's arguments without actually having talked to each other. So I just wanted you to know before it shows up that I actually submitted that on Wednesday of last week, and it comes out tomorrow morning. So, but we echo a number of common themes.
Well, my lawyers will be talking with your lawyers later, so.
All right.
Well, thank you very much for calling in, Jerry. What a great way to end our March Madness melee. And I just want to invite everybody, please join us again next week. We're going to have a couple of our friends on, Claude Berube and B.J. Armstrong, for those that follow them and the U.S. Naval Academy Museum on Twitter and also on their website. In the course of renovating some of our captured battle flags, actually the battle flags we captured in War of 1812, they discovered captured flags from a previous conflict that we had on the Korean Peninsula. We're going to talk about their little archaeological discovery and also help everybody understand that our history of Korea well predates the Korean War. So look forward to talking to everybody then. Thank you very much for joining us, and I hope y'all have a great Navy Day. Cheers, everybody.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly.